This is Every Man a King, a short, colorful history of American populists. This week, Trey Gowdy, representative from South Carolina's 4th District, examines the career of legendary former Louisiana Governor Huey Long. Now, your host, Fox News politics editor, Chris Steyerwalt.
Hi, I'm Chris Steyerwalt, and this is Every Man a King. I wrote a book, and now you're going to hear about it. But since you don't want to hear about it from me all the time, we're bringing in interesting, knowledgeable people to talk about the subject matter of my book, which is, of course, American Populists. Now, someone who is popular, but I don't think a populist, is Trey Gowdy. He is, for now, the representative of the Fightin' Fourth in South Carolina. He has announced that he is not running for office again and will leave Congress and boo. Thanks for leaving us here. And I would also say that Trey Gowdy represents a part of South Carolina that is, well, my people. It's the hillbilly firewall part of South Carolina. It is not the gentrified coastal. It is the upstate Scots-Irish, Presbyterian, born fighting kind of people.
Yes,
and that's who you are, too. So thanks for being with us.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you for writing this book.
Well, I was too good to you. I was far too good to you, and I gave you Huey Pierce Long, which is the title of the book comes from Huey Pierce Long. Every Man a King is what he said. And when you think about Huey Long, are you more scared or amused?
Scared, because of what it reflects. To me, populism is a reflection of where the electorate or the American people are. And the fact that someone, I mean, you made him really entertaining, and I thought you did a really good job of highlighting both his good and bad qualities. I have a tendency to dwell on the bad qualities, and it does make you wonder how someone could rise to that level, even being discussed as a potential competitor to Roosevelt, how they could be. You could never, ever now get away with not taking your seat in the Senate because you wanted to control what was happening in your home state, I don't think.
So what the congressman is referring to, in 1934, Huey Long ran for Senate because the legislature in Louisiana, Long ruled with dictatorial power, absolute dictatorial power in Louisiana. But because he was a lame duck, the legislature was becoming resistant to his demands. And so he ran for Senate as basically a plebiscite in Louisiana to say, and he won. He won a, much like Vladimir Putin, he wins. He definitely wins, but it's rigged too. He doesn't take any chances. He may be popular, but he doesn't take any chances. And famously, in one precinct or in one parish in Louisiana, the people actually were kind enough to vote in alphabetical order.
Oh, to have that level of passion among your supporters.
That they line up.
So you need an enemy. That's what struck me. Is he had two. He had Big Oil, but he also had the media.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the thing I kept coming back to is, how do populists rise? And to me, leaders are kind of aspirational. It's where you want to take people, whereas populism, and this is an oversimplification, but populism is a reflection of where they are now. The fact that he was able to marginalize some of his political opponents, arguably even leading to his own assassination, by saying they were of mixed race descent.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got the racial component. You've got you have to have an enemy, Standard Oil and or the media. His background was fascinating. A little bit lawyer, although he didn't manage to go to law school. Didn't bother to finish. Preacher, salesman. I get the allure initially. I guess what I don't get about populism is I think he'd still be at it had he not been shot. I don't think anybody would have ever said, you know what, we get the joke. We're not going to follow you anymore.
Now, so Long was, and the congressman referenced Huey Long was not born poor. He was born in a very poor place in America. He was born in a place in America that is still poor. Winfield Parish, Louisiana, if you've ever driven through it, the heat is oppressive. It's in a pine barren that is basically a stop on the road between Natchez and I don't know, wherever you go, Beaumont or someplace in East Texas. And Huey Long was born to a fairly well-to-do family there. But then he had, you know, my grandfather had a brother. They were born in a town smaller than – they were born in a town that isn't even a town anymore. And his brother loved it there, and all he wanted was a good horse team and his own 15 acres of bottomland. But my grandfather, Newman, wanted out, and he wanted away from there, and he wanted to get to – he ended up going to Detroit for the $5 day to try to get on the $5 day and all of that stuff. He had the itch, and Huey Long had the itch. And he – it's interesting. I don't think I included it in the book, but there's a moment where he is on the high school debate team, and they go to the Capitol. They go to Baton Rouge for the state debate championship, and he came back, and he knew. And his sister recalled later, I'm going. Like, I'm shaking the dust of this one-horse town off my feet, and I'm going to go do great things. How, when you look at people, and you've sat and looked at people in a courtroom, you've sat and looked at people testifying in front of you, you've talked to a million voters, you've shaken a million hands, where does ambition cross the line with a politician? How do we know? Because you have to be crazy to do what you do. Inherently, you got to be nuts to say, I want to go put myself out, be subject to the verdict of my fellow Americans, and then go, and obviously you've had enough, but and then go sit in with these other 435 crazy people and try to make laws. How do we know when somebody is the right amount ambitious and too much ambitious?
That's a great question. You know, when I was growing up, my father used to say, you have to have an ego to look in the mirror and see a president or see a senator, to think that you are qualified to lead, even at the House level, 700,000. To me, I kind of break it down as your ambition overt or covert. Mm-hmm. But there's no one in Congress who is not ambitious.
Right.
I mean, they don't draft you. You actually have to run, and you have to file and pay a filing fee.
Raise money, hire people.
All of that. So
go to the crawfish boil. Yeah.
The notion of being a reluctant leader is I don't want to say a facade. If you're that reluctant, you would not have run in the first place.
Right.
The line is between overt and covert, and the line to me is whether or not your ambition is on behalf of other people or whether or not your ambition is just naked. And that's the best I can do, but you cannot be on the school board without having some notion of ambition.
Absolutely. And there was a guy, his name was James Madison. He was pretty popular, and he said that ambition must be made to counteract ambition. That will never drive ambition out of our system. That the point that instead of saying we are going to live in a paradise where people rule out of benevolence, instead we're going to create a system that acknowledges the ambition of all the members of the House and all the members of the Senate and the presidency and the courts, and we're going to pit them against each other to hold them in check. What was scary for me in the research of this, you look at 1936. So Long gets killed in August, I think August or the beginning of September, 1935. And he was, as you alluded to, shot by the son-in-law of one of his political rivals, a judge who had refused to rubber stamp whatever unconstitutional, ludicrous, dictatorial demand that Huey Long had made. And so he ruined him. And Huey didn't just ruin him. He ruined his drove his relatives and children out of their jobs as teachers. As you said, came up with a racial slur against him, all of this stuff. And his son-in-law snapped and showed up and emptied a revolver into Huey Long's belly. Now, of course, one of the ironies for Long, and talk about condign punishment. One of the ironies for Long is he probably would have lived if he hadn't removed the qualified doctor who was the state's the Surgeon General of Louisiana in favor of a political hack from his machine, and the guy couldn't do anything, and Huey Long died of his wounds as a result. But when you look at what was going on in the summer of 1935, and you look at how willing Americans had become to accept crazy things. Long was not alone. Father Charles Coughlin was a hugely popular radio demagogue, railing against the Jews, railing against all of these un-Americanness. Americans, and I guess what I would say is, I'm sad that my country, which is rich, which is at basically full employment, wages are rising, we are at peace substantially around the world. There are obviously always problems, but the Pax Americana is robust. Things are good, and yet Americans in this moment, in 1935, you're looking at 25%, 20% of the workforce out of a job. You're looking at the rise of fascism around the world. You're looking at America in big, big trouble. And we are somehow willing now to breach smaller Republican norms. What do we attribute this to? Why are we so rich and powerful but still so miserable?
You put your finger on it. I mean, when you quoted Madison and you were talking about – he was talking about it within the context of our legislative branch. But he was also – if you look at the Federalist Papers, they had a very dim view of human nature. And that human nature has to be checked. Self-interest would be really at the top of the list for most of us in terms of identifying human nature. And we're getting ready to – actually, this afternoon, I'm going to go meet with Tim Scott to meet Brett Kavanaugh. So we're going to confirm someone, perhaps, for
– oh.
It might be close.
Well, this will air probably – this will be published probably after he's confirmed. But I'm willing to bet you a new BMW from the BMW plant in your district that Brett Kavanaugh will be confirmed.
You can afford one on your salary. I cannot. So I'll take you up on that. But that's the highest echelon of that branch. And – and one of the questions, some of the questions he's going to get is about that check on ambition. And remember, Republicans did not like executive overreach when there's a Democrat in the White House. We're a little quieter when there are executive orders coming from our own. So when I think about what's going on now, it is, again, your leaders either aspire, they inspire you to want – they either appeal to your best angels or they reflect. And the easiest thing to do in the world is to find a big crowd and then go ratify or validate what they already believe.
Absolutely.
And that it's somebody else's fault that you don't have a job. It's big old. It's the media. I mean, the media – I was struck by the fact that he used the media as a punching bag. I don't know if you've noticed. Others still
there
do
that.
There
may be. There may be.
From time to time.
From time to time. Not that I've ever stood in a pen in the back of an event hall and had a crowd of people turn and scream at me. But anyway –
so you need an enemy,
right.
I think, to be a successful populist, and you need to reflect. And if you have a dim view of human nature, which as a former prosecutor you might imagine I do,
yeah,
then you are reflecting sometimes people's worst misplaced fears and apprehensions. Sometimes they're well-placed, but oftentimes if you use race, if you use status war. He loved to use personal insult. You know, Whistle Bridges isn't the worst thing in the world be called right now.
In 1930, calling somebody was, and he referred to a guy. There was another turkey neck Walmsley, and Whistle Bridges was for a guy who suffered from a digestive ailment, he called him Whistle Bridges. Yes, and he was very good at insulting people.
How about the young lady that showed up with a plate of food?
Oh my gosh!
I mean. That's wrong in any generation.
So Huey Long, and this actually sets up what I want to talk about. So Huey Long in the summer of 1935, and you can see as you read about Long, he's careening. The train is going so fast, and he is seriously being talked about as a primary and talking about himself as a primary competitor to FDR. Who is the country has gone into a second dip of the Depression. We're coming out of the Depression, and then boom, crash again. People are talking about Long, and basically Long's agenda, he never spelled it out because he was a charlatan and a fraud, but basically Long's agenda was we will outlaw fortunes greater than I think it was $8 million, and we will redistribute the money across the country so that everybody has enough money for a car and a house and enough food to eat, and we're just going to do it. And he, in 1935, is growing in popularity. He claimed to have 7 million members of Share Our Wealth societies across the country. That may or may not be true, but it was a movement, and it was happening. And the way it was happening was that the National Broadcasting Company, NBC, gave him a remarkable platform. And he would go up to New York. He stayed. He lived at the Hotel New Yorker when he was in town. A real man of the people. And that was where he did my favorite Huey Long story. Was he was tired in those days. A popular drink was called a gin fizz. A gin fizz is so disgusting that it is it shocks the conscience. But it involves egg white. It involves powdered sugar. It involves orange water. Shaken and in a froth. It is a stomach churner no matter what. And the citizens of the state of Louisiana paid for the bartender from the Sazerac Bar at the hotel in New Orleans where he lived when he was in New Orleans. You get the sense that Mrs. Long didn't get to see a lot of the senator. But the state flew him to New York, to the Hotel New Yorker, so that he could do a demonstration for the Sazerac-style Ramos gin fizz. And he holds court and does all this stuff. I want to talk about, though, the platform. We in the media, and I have to be very careful with myself about who do we elevate? NBC elevated Huey Long and made possible this nightmare scenario where he could have done, and I think it wasn't going to happen, and I'm going to trust the better angels of our virtue, that we wouldn't have done that. But Huey Long was running on a platform to do to America what he did to Louisiana and make himself a dictator. As he said, how could I be a dictator if I was fully executing the will of the people? And it's like, well, actually, that's what a dictator is. How do we in the media do this wrong in terms of valuing small R Republican values?
God, that's a good question. It's a tough question because I don't like gratuitously banging on the media.
No, I know you don't.
But I tell my friends in the media, not only do you report the news, you get to decide what the news is.
Right.
You have a choice every day of what to do, what to spend your time on. And I am in no way, shape, or form comparing this candidate to Huey Long. I want to make that incredibly clear. But the candidate that beat Joe Crowley, I don't think anyone outside of New York had heard about until a month ago.
In an election where she got 12,000 votes.
She is
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Right. And congratulations to her for having the courage to run against an incumbent. And obviously she ran a fantastic campaign and I haven't met her. So I got a lot of progressive friends. She might have been one had I stayed. But the notion that you can go from winning a fairly small primary to immediate national, if not international, notoriety is not something she could have done on her own.
Right.
And it makes me sit there and think, and I sit beside on the floor another young woman that I think is really impressive named Elise Stefanik.
Yeah.
And she's not a household name.
No.
Now, is that because Elise doesn't want it?
And they're about the same age. They're from the same state.
They're both great stories about really talented, smart young women who decided to run for public office. One is seen as part of a savior of a party, and the other, most of your listeners probably are going to have to Google her to find out who she is.
Right.
So I to not place all the blame on the media, I think the media responds to a market and an appetite and a demand. And if my demand is for conflict or if my demand is for insults, if I really want to support a candidate who belittles a young woman because she's got too much food on her plate, then that says a lot more about me than it does about you for sharing the story.
Huey Long, I got sidetracked. I didn't finish the story. He was on his many trips to New York to go demagogue on NBC, he went out to a swanky party on Long Island and was so drunk, was absolutely rip-roaring drunk, too many gin fizzes, shows up at the party, snatches a plate away from a woman who is sitting there eating and says, I'll take this. You're too fat already. Then he goes into the washroom, and there is a line at the urinal, and he says to the man who is using that facility, he says, make way for the kingfish. And by the way, he took the nickname Kingfish. This will tell you everything about Huey Long. the nickname Kingfish. So there was a radio minstrel show, Amos and Andy, that was the most popular radio show in the country. And the Kingfish was a character on the show who was a fraudster. He was a scam artist who convinced Amos and Andy to get into wild, harebrained schemes and get rich quick and all that stuff. Somebody called him the Kingfish pejoratively, and he said, "You're right, I am the Kingfish." But he says, "Make way for the Kingfish." The guy won't yield. So the senator from Louisiana micturated upon the trouser leg of this individual, who understandably punched him, gives him a black eye. They get Long out of there, and the New York newspapers, as you might imagine, as soon as this gets out, this is a sensation. And he's in a drunken fight in a men's room, and he peed on somebody, and this is so Huey gets, he's going out to Milwaukee, I think, to give a speech and keep rousing the rabble. And he gets out there, and he dispatches a statement. He said that the deep state came for him, that he was there in the washroom, yes, and a bunch of assassins came to kill him because he was trying to share our wealth. And he's lucky that he only escaped with his life. And what was amazing was it seemed like they bought it.
And this is the question I would have for you is, did they buy it or did it not matter?
And I think that's the key. And I think we see that with politicians now. I think we see it with the current president. I think we saw it with the former president, which is basically some of the people. It's this is going to sound weird. Donald Trump, Barack Obama, a lot of politicians now are Katy Perry's, which is to say, do you like it? Well, if you don't, LOL. I'm only kidding. Unless if you're going for it, then I'm going to keep selling it. But at the moment that somebody says that I've gone too far, I've done the wrong thing, I say, oh, lols, I was just kidding. So I think that's very true. What effect social media has changed, and the smartphones that we carry have changed our culture, I would argue, more than radio. This was the era where radio changed everything, though, right? This was the dramatic departure from everything that we had known before. From the time of the founding until the 1920s, the means of communication was substantially the same. Newspapers were how people got their news, and that was it. Starting in the 20s, radio arrives, and arrives in a big way, and it changes everything. And Huey Long was very much a product of this. He used the radio to get his message out. He even took his nickname from a radio show. He was very much a man of the moment. I don't think that we can possibly appreciate the change that social media and smartphones are doing to us. What do you think?
Well, I'm older than you are. My generation cannot appreciate it except for the fact that I live with two 20-year-olds, and I haven't seen their eyes in 6 years. I've seen the top of their heads, but not their eyes.
Yeah, Dad. Yeah, Dad.
What it does to me, Chris, is, I mean, I think one of the fundamental tenets of our country is that all opinions have equal worth, but they don't have equal value. Mm-hmm. And social media elevates the value of everyone's opinion. And it doesn't matter that you don't have access to all the facts. And it doesn't matter that you've never experienced it. You have the right, and I put that in quote, Austin Powers air quotes, you have the right to express your opinion. And there's an increasing expectation that people are going to take it seriously. So it is... You know, speaking of Elise and other young members of Congress or candidates, they have figured out how to master social media. I mean, President Trump communicates in a far different way than President Reagan did.
Mm-hmm.
He goes straight to the people. He doesn't have a press conference. I mean, he's very active. He's very active on Twitter. My concern is all issues can't be reduced to 140 characters, and there's very little dialogue on social media. This is my opinion. You can like it or you can not like it. It's just hard to have a conversation.
And I may even like it better if you don't like it. There may be virtue, right? There may be virtue in hate. And Huey Long took strength from the hate that people felt for him. And when his critics in Louisiana and when FDR and I think FDR saw this, but his critics in Louisiana, they came hard for him. And that gave him the excuse to escalate and ratchet up in response.
It also gives him the opportunity to minimize his critics, which sometimes are perceived to be in the media. And this is where I think the media does get it wrong. sometimes they make no effort to understand. They're going to spend a lot of energy trying to understand Huey Long or any other perceived populist. I think they spend less time trying to figure out what motivates people to support folks like Huey Long. And the reason they don't want to do it is those are some of their same viewers. So you don't want to psychoanalyze your viewers too much for fear that you may criticize them and you need them watching. My dad was just dumbfounded that Bill Clinton could be elected twice. I mean, when I grew up, I would always say, Dad.
Your dad and my dad were not. We're together on this count.
But I mean, my dad was a medical doctor. He followed politics. I would say, Dad, do not be mad at Bill Clinton. He is what he is. If you want to be upset with someone, be upset with your fellow citizens who actually elected him.
That's right.
But it's just it's easier to focus your anger on individuals. They personify something. I keep coming back to human nature. How do we allow what about us makes it that it doesn't matter whether Huey Long urinated on somebody's trouser or whether or not he was defending the honor of his platform? I mean, it does matter.
It does matter.
And it matters whether or not he's telling you the truth, because if you can't believe him on this issue, how can you believe him on some big policy? But the more people are attacked sometimes, the less it matters or not they're truthful. They've almost earned the right to use similar tactics because they're being used against them.
And as we started, we're going to conclude where we started, which was he was very good about picking his enemies. Good politicians pick their enemies. And every politician does it to a certain degree. But you say, well, I am here arrayed against the great power of the corrupting force of Standard Oil, and I am here to fight for you. And in the end, the folks, as he said, I don't care what anybody thinks of me except for the boys at the forks of the creek. I only care what my people think. And my people know that I'm fighting Standard Oil, and any calumny that comes my way because of Standard Oil, it's all because I'm fighting for you. And Americans do have a tendency to accept, and I think Bill Clinton was a good example of this. I think our current president is a good example of this, which is, well, look, he may do things wrong, but he does them for me. What he's doing for he may not be a good guy, but he's my bad guy. And I think that that is a something that Long tapped into very well.
Well, your book was I read that chapter in one sitting, and that is no compliment to my public school education in South Carolina. It was, I mean, you're a very good writer, but it's also really, really interesting. It left me hoping at some point you'll write a book about people who lost. Populism is. You have to be successful at a certain extent to be a populist. At this point in my life, I would rather you have some qualities that I really respect and lose, like a Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
The greatest.
Martin Luther King Jr., who wrote a letter from jail. There's a reason he was in jail.
Abraham Lincoln, who came home from one term. After one term, he fought his own party on the Black Hawk War and got to go back to Springfield to be postmaster.
That, the willingness to lie for success is one thing. The willingness to lose for success is something else. And I'm a lot older than you, so I'm to the point where I like the stories of people who believed in enough to lose.
All right, so I'm asking everybody this. The name of the book is Every Man a King. If you were a king for one day, if we could give Trey Gowdy absolute monarchical rule over the federal government to change anything that you wanted, if you were king for one day, what's the one thing that you would change in our system to make the country better?
Wow. What would I change to make the country better?
And it has to be a law. It has to be a rule. You can't say that everyone will have goodness in their heart.
I'm not sure how we legislate that. This will surprise and disappoint you and ensure that I never run for public office again.
Stand by.
I think we need to do something with the First Amendment. I had this conversation with Facebook and Twitter during the Russia investigation.
Yep.
Today, I'm pretty sure, is Wednesday.
As far as we know.
All right. So for me to tweet out or for me to write a long Facebook post about how today is Tuesday is incorrect.
And only the libs would say it's Wednesday. And if you disagree with me, you're wrong and obviously a big lib.
But what is the value of me being able to propagate mistruth and falsehood? And And you know, your question is going to be, well, who gets to be the arbiter?
Yes.
I get that. But right. certain things are either factually correct or factually incorrect. And I think the standard of having to prove malice mm-hmm. is a high standard. And I wish there was more of an incentive to take care that you did not make statements you know to be false or fail to investigate.
Is it like the British system in which they have a free press, but if you don't need – they don't have a Sullivan v. New York Times yeah. standard
right.
in Britain. So what we're talking about here is in the United States – I can say anything I want about Trey Gowdy. I can go out. He's a public figure. He's run for office. I can go say anything that I want about him, and I can say that he is secretly raising Shetland ponies in his congressional office and that he is in the employ of Xi Jinping. I can say anything I want, and as long as Trey Gowdy cannot demonstrate that I did so maliciously, if he says, this is untrue, how dare you say this? My absolute defense is to say, well, I didn't mean any harm by it. I believed it was true. I heard it from a guy.
Right.
I'm sorry. So then I'm held harmless. And as a journalist, I like this. This is a good thing.
I don't want you to think I'm singling out journalists. We mentioned social media.
Right, right.
Where is the line if I am a active social media person? I mean, I don't know what it means to be a journalist anymore. Sidney Blumenthal said he was a journalist. I mean, I don't know. I mean, am I a journalist because I tweet 4 or 5 times a day? What is – I mean, there's no test you have to take to be a journalist.
Thank God.
So
I'd be working at a Radio Shack. Yeah.
So it's not just those of you who are identified as being part of the media. I can start a blog. Does that mean I'm a journalist?
So to conclude, your remedy would be something like creating a British-style standard for that malice of forethought is not required to hold people responsible for sharing untruths.
I don't want to mess with the damages. I don't think you ought to get $1 million because you accuse me of being a squish or a rhino.
Right.
Actually, both of those are opinions. They wouldn't be fact. If you were to falsely accuse me of being a friend of Mick Mulvaney's, hypothetically.
If that got out, you're ruined.
I'm fine with the nominal $1 damage. Mm-hmm. I do not understand the value of a system where I have the right to speak something that is not only demonstrably false, but I know it is false when I am saying it. I think if our – for every right you have, there's a corresponding responsibility.
Amen.
You have the right to free speech, but you have the responsibility to take care that you don't slander and malign people. And I think it has gotten to where we focus more on the right and less on the responsibility. So I'd like to tweak New York Times where at least there's an equal incentive to do both.
Civil libertarians out there, you can reach – what's your Twitter handle?
JustinAmash.com.
Yes, exactly. Well, Congressman, we're so privileged that you came in to talk to us.
Thank you
for taking a look at the book. And
it's fantastic. I really, really enjoyed it.
Thank you for saying so. And thank you most of all for your service because
thank you.
Whatever ambition you have or had, you have meted it out with dignity and you have done it the right way. And your constituents have been fortunate.
Thank you. Kind to say that. Thank you.
All right, America, the name of the book is Every Man a King. You should urgently buy it because you want my children to go to a good college. That's Every Man a King. And we'll talk to you next time.